Welcome to Inside the Guard,
the show that takes an in-depth look at the biggest fights from a weekend of MMA. I'm your host, TP Grant. UFC 183 was an event full of fights with interesting narratives and meaning for both their contestants and their divisions. The lead into the event was one of the most harrowing 24-hour periods for MMA fans in recent memory, however. The main event of 184, UFC 184 that is, was derailed as middleweight champion Chris Weidman was forced to withdraw due to an injury, leaving that card utterly decapitated. It was quickly followed by the news that Stephen Wonderboy Thompson was also out of his main event on Valentine's Day against Brandon Thatch, who has since been replaced by Benson Henderson. This all went along with the news that repeat weigh-in offenders Kelvin Gastelum and John Lineker had again missed their marks on the scales. Gastelum reportedly suffering from flu-like symptoms and was forced to call off his cut and be rushed to the hospital to rehydrate, but was somehow allowed to continue to fight. And just before the card was ready to kick off, Jimmy Hettis was removed from his match with Diego Brandão for an undisclosed medical reason that just took that fight off the card. And for the second time in less than 24 hours, a fighter on the UFC 183 card was taken to the hospital, though unlike Gastelum, Hettis would not return to the octagon to compete. With all this drama leading in, it was a relief when the fights finally started, and in all honesty, fans were treated to a card full of quality MMA violence, and its culmination was a bout between Anderson Silva and Nick Diaz, which it didn't live up to every expectation that people put on it, but it was an entertaining, and it was as entertaining, I should say, and tactical as one could have hoped for in a match between two such crafty veterans of the sport. Now, Anderson Silva won a decision handily, and I feel correctly. He took five rounds on Glenn Trowbridge and Marcos Rosales' scorecards, and four rounds on Sal D'Amato's card. D'Amato gave Nick Diaz the fourth round, which I don't have a huge issue with people who gave Diaz one round, either the fourth or the first, though I don't think the first was necessarily justified. There was a lot of inactivity in the first round, both fighters kind of getting a feel for things, and while Diaz taunted quite a bit, he actually didn't have quite that much offense, and Silva really finished the last 2 minutes of that fight on the offensive. So really what we ended up seeing was in this match, Silva stuck to the fundamentals of his defensively tilted striking style. He was always circling, always forcing Diaz to readjust, and never letting Diaz set up his linear attacks that end his victims kind of trapped against the cage where he can just unload on them. Silva established his jab really early on in the first round, and then the clinch game was quick to behind that. Though Diaz did have a fair amount of success in the clinch, it was clear that Diaz didn't want to spend a great deal of time in the clinch. So Silva kind of set up that jab to keep Diaz kind of out of that mid-range. And then if he came charging in closer, Silva looked to clinch up, which is a place where I think most people agreed Silva had the advantage. And I think Diaz performed better than expected in the clinch. But I also don't think Diaz was very happy to be there. And then after those two things got established and Diaz kind of ended up a little further on the outside, that's when Silva really brought in his leg kick game. And at that point, he had constructed a layered defense of counters that Diaz had to navigate to land any offense of his own. And to Diaz's credit, he absolutely did. But Diaz's overall offensive ability was deflated compared to his performances in other fights, and Silva coasted to a pretty easy victory in what was a really veteran performance from Anderson Silva. And let's not make any mistake about this. This was a legacy win for Anderson. It really does very little for his standing as a middleweight as a whole currently, aside from heralding his return to the division and return to fighting. It answered quite a few questions concerning Silva's health. His leg seemed strong. He had no qualms about kicking with that leg. It looked good. And given he was facing the dreaded Diaz check game, which, I mean, I have to think that was part of this matchup, was the idea that Silva would be able to throw leg kicks without real fear of getting them checked. But I also, in a camp as organized and meticulous as Ed Suarez and Anderson Silva tend to run, I can't imagine that he got into the cage not feeling confident that he could throw leg kicks with that leg. So I very much doubt that Anderson was surprised or in any way seriously doubting his ability to kick. Almost as importantly, Anderson's conditioning seemed to be on point. He clearly was able to go five rounds without slowing down a great deal. And his ability to take a punch is still very much there. I think it's really obvious at this point that Chris Weidman is a really special case, far more than people were giving him credit for. The fact that he dropped Anderson Silva three times in two fights is an anomaly. There are not a lot of Chris Weidmans out there, and Anderson Silva is still a very, very good striker. Now, it is clear that Anderson is more hittable in the past. I believe this is the second most amount of strikes Anderson Silva's ever taken in a fight, the most being when he fought Chael Sonnen for the first time, and the vast majority of those came on the ground. And so that would make, excluding his early pre-Pride career, which I'm not sure if there are statistics on those, I believe it's the most Anderson Silva has ever been hit on the feet. So credit to Nick Diaz for that. But while that's true, he also seems to be fighting with a more subtly defensive game than before. Anderson Silva's defense was always very obvious. He had the big, big head movement and the big motions and making guys miss very blatantly. And while Silva has decisions to make concerning his family and if he wants to continue his career, he seemed very undecided about that. If Anderson Silva does decide to continue fighting, I think this style of fight could be one that he could continue on against higher-level fighters for some time. In a way very similar to aging boxing greats are able to fight well into their 40s and 50s, relying more on experience, guile, and then a highly developed craft of boxing, and in Anderson Silva's case, MMA striking, to kind of carry the day for them against younger, more athletic, or still athletic, I should say, fighters. Now, for Diaz, this was just another example that if he is unable to fight his fight, he just doesn't have the ability to adjust against upper-level fighters. And I'm not saying that Diaz isn't a skilled fighter. He's an immensely skilled fighter. Don't get me wrong here. He was a game-changer striker. He was on the leading edge of kind of the volume striking movement in MMA when there was that big shift in how people struck in MMA and the kind of loading up power shots generation kind of faded away. In fact, the term volume striking at least entered my MMA lexicon listening to people trying to describe Nick Diaz's boxing when he was in Strikeforce. And it seems to be the old saying that Nick Diaz fights great, but Anderson Silva is a great fighter. And I think this fight really kind of demonstrated that, because what you had was, as I said before, Nick Diaz likes to play a very linear game. He pushes forward on fighters, and he traps them against the fence. And once they're against the fence and unable to move, he just unloads on them and fires off great combination punching, body hit shots to head shots, working everything together, working in low-power shots with kind of high-power shots. He never throws anything like 100% his entire body weight behind it, but he throws a whole bunch of stuff at 60% and then will mix in like a couple 80% shots when he sees a really, really big opening and just keeps the pressure on you. And it breaks guys down, and it's broken down some great strikers. But Anderson Silva, the entire fight, was constantly moving sideways. He was always employing circular movement, which kept his back off the cage. He established his ranges very early on, and he made Diaz pay for getting into range. And Diaz absolutely won some exchanges. I mean, Diaz is a very competent striker. He wasn't going to go into this fight and lose every single exchange. He definitely caught Anderson a couple times. He definitely came away the better in certain exchanges. But over the course of the fight, Anderson Silva was consistently winning more exchanges based off of that circular movement and the ability for him to fight at really all ranges. Diaz worked some kicking game, but I mean, Anderson Silva's leg kicking game was far more effective than Nick's kicks. And then once inside with the boxing, Anderson was landing really, really hard counters at times, snapping back Nick's head and just consistently being on target, being the far more accurate striker for the match. So it was an interesting battle of distance as Nick tried to continually get Anderson against the fence and into his wheelhouse. and Anderson continually using footwork to take angles and just keep things where he liked them. And when you look at the guys who have had success against Anderson, I mean, Chael Sonnen hurt Anderson on the feet, and he did it by faking a takedown and then coming down the pipe with a right hand. And Nick Diaz doesn't really have that in his arsenal. And then Chris Weidman, I mean, just an outstanding wrestler, so that's in the back of Silva's head. And then just really outstanding power, and then an excellent pressure fighter who refused to back up in the face of Anderson Silva. And that, what to me was the big difference, was that Diaz, number one, didn't really have the varied game. He has good wrestling, but he very rarely mixes it in with his striking. When Diaz is in there, he's looking to box with guys and maybe mix in a few kicks. And then if you take him down, he'll play a ground game. But other than that, he really has no interest in taking things to the mat. So you pretty much know what you're getting with Diaz. And then you throw in the fact that Chris Weidman had the power to drop Anderson Silva, which Nick Diaz demonstrably did not have. So when you throw that together, I mean, it very much appears that Nick Diaz really was just more the victim of matchup than anything else. Patrick Wyman put it very well in one of his 18 breakdowns of this fight. I don't even remember which one, because he's on every show that you can possibly find. Historically, the idea that the pressure fighter has the advantage against the pure counter fighter, and I think we saw that with Chris Weidman, Anderson Silva, the way he very much threw Anderson Silva off his regular striking game. But in this case, while Nick Diaz, is a pressure fighter, he just didn't have the necessary tools and footwork to really make Anderson Silva, or put Anderson Silva, in the same bad positions as Chris Weidman. And the result was fairly predictable in that case. Though, what really made this fight for Anderson was the fact that he was able to keep up with Diaz and keep going that pace for a full five rounds. So I think the things to take out of this are, number one, that Anderson Silva looked very, very good in his return, though I very much would not want to see him fighting Chris Weidman again. I don't think he's at that championship level again. I think these kind of big-name fights for Anderson Silva, get him some legacy fights. He'll have some outstanding performances in there. He'll have some like tonight, or I should say last night, which, while not outstanding, was also, I mean, it was an entertaining fight. We got a lot of interesting stuff out of it. We're getting some good discussion, and we got a very, like, subtle and crafty match. And for Nick Diaz, I mean, anyone who says Nick Diaz sucks based off of this performance, I mean, you can just ignore that. That's clearly someone who was just looking for an excuse to tear down Nick. He just is what he is. He's a really good fighter, technically brilliant, likes to get in there and scrap, but just I think at this point it's pretty much beyond a doubt, just doesn't really get how MMA is scored and is in there fighting by his own kind of thought process on what fighting should be, and it works for him sometimes and other times it doesn't. And frankly, I enjoy the heck out of his fights, and to me at times it doesn't even matter if he wins or loses. I'm just enjoying him being in the cage. So those are my big takeaways. Now, this card had a great deal more to digest and than just the main event, so I'm going to run down some rapid-fire thoughts on some of the fights on this card, and then we're going to go in-depth on the arm triangle that Talis Lictis used to tap out Tim Boach. The co-main event of the evening was Tyrone Woodley versus Kelvin Gastelum, and Gastelum missed weight horribly coming into this fight. He was apparently sick, was rushed to the hospital, and in all honesty, should not have been fighting in this match. And despite all that, he actually looked quite good. Kelvin Gastelum is a very good young fighter, and at this point, his mindset and approach to training and fighting and everything else that goes with it is really what's holding him back. Because he looked quite competent in this fight, and Tyrone Woodley is a guy who is always on point, always ready to fight, and the biggest issue with him is just kind of which Tyrone Woodley you get in the cage. And Kelvin Gastelum actually fought the fight that you need to fight to beat Tyrone Woodley. You need to back Tyrone Woodley up, who is very content to back up and wing right hands, but is markedly less effective when he's backing up. And Gastelum was constantly pushing him against the fence and then letting him off the hook. And as the fight wore on, Gastelum became visibly tired as Woodley took over. So there wasn't a ton to take away from this fight. It wasn't exactly a thrilling fight. The split decision, it both indicates that Gastelum did better than I think a lot of people expected, but it was also a bit of a joke because Tyron Woodley, at least in my eyes, absolutely won that fight. Woodley is on the verge of, I think he's beyond the verge. He's an elite welterweight at this point, despite his shortcomings. He's incredibly strong. He's a powerful striker. He's a very skilled fighter. He's very, very difficult to take down. And at this point, I want to see Woodley either fighting a number one contenders type match to see if he can get in there to fight for a title. For Gastelum, this knocks him firmly off of the phenom prospect track, both the weight issues and the loss here. And hopefully he can kind of rally and come back for this because he's an extremely talented young man, just 23 years old. But these are the sort of problems that can really set you back a year or two. And frankly, anytime you do that, it's time wasted. And speaking of guys who are on the rise, the second fight on the card of Al Ian Quinta, he looked outstanding in his fight against Joe Lauzon. And this fight really seemed like one last test matchmaking-wise for Ian Quinta, who looks like a solid top 10 lightweight in the making. And his only real problem has been the ground game. And most prospects end up with a submission loss on their record on their way up through the weight ranks. But Ian Quinta had three losses by submission, one of them coming to Mitch Clark from like the fluky from the bottom of side control, Darce choke. He also got rear naked choked by Michael Chiesa in the Ultimate Fighter finale, and then I believe he got armbarred before he got into it. I mean, it denoted a real hole in his game. But Ian Quinta has been working with Matt Serra, and I feel like this fight against Joe Lauzon was kind of the UFC asking Ian Quinta to prove that he could handle a submission specialist, and he did, and he completely avoided the ground game, and for Ian Quinta, that's exactly what he should be doing. There's no reason for him to be kind of mixing it up on the ground when he's as good a striker as he is, and I expect Ian Quinta to start being matched against ranked lightweights soon. Moving on down the card, Jordan Mean, my goodness, what a fight. And one thing I said this on MMA Prospectus at the beginning or last Friday, is that he really shouldn't be considered a prospect by anyone. Mean has 39 professional fights. That's a lot for those of you keeping score at home. At this point, he is as good of a fighter as he's likely to get. He probably will get a little bit better as time goes on, but he's not going to be making like those massive strides from fight to fight. That's not to say he's a bad fighter. I mean, he's a really good fighter. And he was tuning up Thiago Alves on the feet until the tables were turned by that body kick to the solar plexus and then that follow-up knee. And actually, on the rewatch, it appeared that knee was legal as Mean was kind of crouching down on both feet and he had one hand on the mat. And as Alves came in to throw the knee, Mean's hand actually came off the mat to shield his face. And actually, he only had 2 points of contact when the knee hit. So completely appeared to be a legal knee. And for Mean, I mean, he was absolutely kicking the snot out of Thiago Alves. Thiago Alves came out in the second round much more aggressive, pressing Mean up against the fence, coming forward. And Mean had kind of that like that forward roll that he did as like kind of a showy way to escape the up against the fence. But Thiago Alves was right back in his face again. And apparently went into Hulk mode because he didn't like being shown up by that role. And for Mean, it's becoming a bit of a pattern for him to come up short in his step-up fights. He lost to Matt Brown. He lost to Tyrone Woodley back in Strikeforce when they were getting Mean ready, when they were trying to position Mean to fight for the title there. And he's clearly going to have more time. Mean's still a young guy. And for all my talk of him having a lot of fights, he's still... I mean, he's not a prospect, but he is in his peak as a fighter. He's still going to be very good for another couple years, at the least. So I expect him to get another chance to kind of move into that upper echelon. But at right now, Mean kind of went from training at American Top Team back to training with his father in kind of their small gym in Canada. And I think a strong move for him would be to move to a larger camp to keep that arrow pointed upwards and to keep improving as a fighter, because there's only so much you can do in a small camp. And that's not to demean the people he's working with at all, but just as it stands, there are a small handful of really top MMA coaches right now who really get how to train for this sport. And they're pretty limited, and they have a lot of fighters with them. Those big camps produce good fighters for a reason, and it's not just because the talent comes to them. It's because there's really good coaching there. Now, Moving down again, Sarah McMahon had a very disappointing showing against Misha Tate. Tate was able to survive a really hard first round. She got her orbital broken by a right hand. And as the fight went on, Tate, a high school wrestler, was able to out-grapple an Olympic silver medalist in McMahon. And now, I think this speaks to, number one, a problem that I think everyone was guilty of at some point as an MMA fan. I know I definitely was, where you put too much weight on grappling credentials. And, I mean, McMahon is like a case study in this because people pegged her as the person to beat Ronda Rousey because she was an Olympic wrestler and Rousey was an Olympic judoka. And in a lot of people's eyes, well, wrestling trumps judo in MMA, so clearly McMahon has the edge. And that ignores the fact that we're fighting in MMA, we're dealing with MMA fighters, and the outcomes have much more to do with who is a more complete an MMA fighter with an integrated MMA game. And that was undoubtedly Ronda Rousey in their fight. And yet again, it kind of reared its head as McMahon, she just doesn't have the mat work to be the grinding wrestler that she wants to be. And I think that's something that needs to be said more often, is that wrestling does not necessarily transfer into mat work. You have very strong mat work wrestlers like a Phil Davis. And then you have people like Sarah McMahon who have very good takedowns, but she really can't follow up on them and frankly gets herself in trouble quite frequently when she does spend too long grappling on the ground. She gives up bad position and she has very little ability off her back when she gets put on her back. Now, obviously, I'm not McMahon's coach, but personally, looking at her strengths, which she has pretty good boxing, she's got good power, and she's got excellent takedowns, she might be better served coming up with a bit more of like a rinse and repeat style wrestler in like the mold of Khabib Nurmagomedov, who uses repeated takedowns and then short blitzes of offense on the ground to wear opponents down. And then he'll blitz him on the ground a little bit, and then he'll let up, and they'll start to get up, and he'll lock up that body lock, and then he'll throw him again, and it'll be just, as I said, rinse and repeat. And that just wears guys down rather than engaging in prolonged grappling exchanges. It's actually what Ronda Rousey does also. She gets her takedown, and then she looks for arm bars, and if she really doesn't like how things are proceeding, she just stands up and resets things on the feet because she has so much faith in her takedown game. And I think in the short term, while McMahon is looking to shore up like kind of a more long-term grappling game on the ground, I think that would be a very realistic way to make her an immediately more dangerous fighter. Derek Brunson got a resounding knockout of Ed Herman very, very quickly, which should herald him into the ranks of the top 15 middleweights. Brunson seems to be hitting his stride as a fighter, and I think a match with Talis Latis would make a lot of sense right now to see which one of them kind of gets to move forward and face a top 10 opponent. And then finally, with my quick rundown here, John Lineker gets a win over Ian McCall after missing weight and McCall mocking him on Instagram as a fatty and things like that. And really what happened here is Lineker used body punching over the course of the rounds to kind of curtail Ian McCall's movement. And then McCall had some success early on with grappling, but Lineker was able to constantly threaten submissions that seemed to really make McCall think twice about taking things to the ground. And I was actually critical of McCall's leg lock defense on Twitter live during the fight. I pointed out that it looked like when Lineker went for a leg lock, McCall stood out of the leg lock and planted the foot that was being attacked on the ground, which you're supposed to. And then it appeared that he actually stepped the leg back across Lineker's body and put himself in an inverted heel hook. And I was rather critical of this. On second watch, I saw that Lineker actually underhooked McCall's leg and moved his leg into position. So McCall was not putting his leg there. And after that, McCall was actually executing a very, very nice 50-50 guard pass. So as some penance, we're going to take a look at a variation of the guard pass or some of the concepts behind the guard pass that McCall was working. I was unable to find a video of McCall that I could get screenshots from, so no images from the actual fight, but we do have a BJJ scout video of Leandro Lowe, who is a guards passing extraordinaire in sport jiu-jitsu, and we're going to take a look at a clip from this video. The complete video will be in the article on bloodyelbow.com. Now, the concept that the BJJ scout is going to outline in this video is that when facing the 50-50 guard, Lowe stands, and this is exactly what McCall did, and he actually was the same leg as pictured here,
The problem that occurred, though, is that instead of overhooking the leg like the opponent here is doing, Lineker actually underhooked and passed the leg to the other side of his body. But McCall kind of stuck with the plan here. He stood, he got his foot on the ground, making him safe from the heel hook and safe from the ankle lock, and then attempted to work the legs open. And eventually he was able to get the legs open and spin around despite it being on the wrong side. So it was a really nice piece of grappling from McCall. And thank you for the BJJ scout for making this video. I included this in the actual article. And if you like this sort of thing, you should go follow him on YouTube, subscribe to his channel. He's also working with Jack Slack with the hashtag Jack.com thing, which live chats during MMA and BJJ events, so you can go check that out. Overall, very, very sharp dude making awesome videos about grappling. That brings us to our final segment, the in-depth look at the arm triangle, specifically the arm triangle that Talis Letas used to choke out Tim Boach. Now, for kind of a laying a foundation here, the arm triangle is exactly what it sounds like. The triangle choke that most MMA fans are familiar with is the one done with the legs. And the way a triangle choke works is that there are two types of chokes, essentially. There are blood chokes and there are air chokes. Air chokes stop oxygen from getting into the lungs, and thus the reduced flow of oxygen to the brain causes unconsciousness. Blood chokes involve putting pressure on the arteries in the neck, which reduces blood flow to the brain. And then it's more complicated, but it causes unconsciousness. There's a whole bunch of medical things that go into it. But essentially, the lights go out very quickly from a blood choke, much faster than from an air choke. And the way a regular triangle works is one side of the leg applies the pressure to one artery, and then the person's own shoulder being driven into the other side of their neck applies pressure to the other artery. Now, here you can see Talis Letas is applying the arm triangle choke to Tim Boach, if you're watching the video. And you can see that Tim Boach's head and arm are encircled by Talis Letas' left arm and his head. The elbow, the inside elbow of Letas' left arm, is applying pressure to the right side of Boach's neck. And Talis Letas' head and collarbone are driving his shoulder into the left side of Boach's neck, thus causing the choke and the unconsciousness. Now, I've worked with the arm triangle before on bloodyelbow.com. I did a judo chop about a year ago titled Jose Aldo Henenbrow and the Nova Uniao Arm Triangle. And I specifically mentioned the camp because Nova Uniao, where Talis Letas also trains, and Talis Letas is actually featured in this article, has an extreme fondness for this choke. And that's mostly because the Nova Uniao team is a jiu-jitsu team that is focused on fighting in MMA. They blend together jiu-jitsu and Muay Thai in a very similar fashion that karate and grappling was blent together to create combat sambo. All the fighters coming out of Nova Uniao, while they will compete in sport jiu-jitsu, they're all learning jiu-jitsu with an eye towards MMA, pretty much from the get-go. And so their grappling games are very much geared towards MMA. And the arm triangle is a fantastic submission because it's very easy to get into if you're striking and people are putting their arms up. Even if you lose it, you don't lose top position in most cases. And it's a choke, which means that even if opponents just try to tough it out, they will be put unconscious and the fight will end. Unlike an arm lock or something like that, where if someone toughs it out, you can break their arm, or you can break their ankle, or you can strain their knee, or their shoulder, and the fight will continue. And we've actually seen instances of guys having their arm broken and then going on to winning matches, but no one's ever been choked unconscious and then won an MMA fight. So chokes are, in that way, a much more reliable submission than joint locks. And Riley Bodycombe on Technique Talk with Luke Thomas put it, why joint lockers in MMA, such as Husamar Pahalas, have to be so merciless and sometimes to ensure that guys tap out. Now, the article, which I will post a link to in the article that actually features this, so keep an eye out for that on Tuesday following the fight, covers the way Nova Uniao guys catch the arm triangle, and they have a whole bunch of ways of getting into it. It's a real they really play that 3D chess game. But the entry that Leitis used to get into the arm triangle against Boach really wasn't anything special. He simply did it from the mount. He was playing low in the mount. He trapped Boach's elbow across with his chest and then went for the arm triangle. He actually went for it twice. Boach actually managed to turn in hard and slide his elbow out of danger because you don't have a choke from that position if you don't have the arm. Triangles only work with the head and the arm. If it's just the head, there are chokes that you can do, but it's no longer a triangle choke. And from the arm triangle position, you really don't have much there in the same way that you really don't have much if you just have the head triangled in between your legs. There are finishes there, but they usually involve a gi or something else. So the choke is usually gone at that point. So what we're going to look at is how exactly Nova Unugai's finish this choke, because pretty much anyone who will grapple will tell you that the arm triangle is a submission that you can find fairly often if you want to find it. It's really not that hard to get into. Finishing it is really tricky, though, sometimes. It can be very easy to blow out your arms. Guys can sit in arm triangles a very long time without going unconscious. And what really sets the Nova Uniel guys apart is their ability to finish the arm triangle. And I have a treat for you people because I found a video of Talos Latest teaching his finish to the arm triangle, which, for those of you watching the video, I'll be putting up right now. So, the first thing that Latest is demonstrating here is the importance to get your head on the mat. This takes away space for the opponent to slip their arm out and allows you to put very, very good pressure down on the choke. So, putting your head to the mat, very, very important detail for at least the Nova Uniel finish. I've seen finishes. I've seen Ryan Hall teach finishes in which your head is off the mat, but the Nova Uniel guys almost universally finish with their head on the mat. Now, the second thing that he's showing here is the importance of getting on the angle. The reason he's coming to that 90-degree angle in the choke is because you need to be driving your opponent's shoulder into his neck. And if you're parallel with him and you push forward, you're actually pushing his shoulder past him. You're not really driving it into the side of his neck. And therefore, you're not really accomplishing the goal of the choke. So by coming around to the side and turning to that like nice 90-degree angle and getting everything flat, you're attempting to get behind the guy's shoulder and then drive it into his neck as you're squeezing. And the other thing that if you watch the video, which again, posting in the article, so keep an eye out for it, especially if you're listening on if you're just listening or something like that, you can check the article. He talks about the importance of constant pressure, that this is not a start and stop choke for Leitis. He is squeezing the entire time. So your conditioning needs to be on point. I mean, like there's a bit of strength required in this, just in the idea that you can maintain the squeeze long enough through a guy's fight. But it's a really, really effective and old submission. And it's not that like Nova Uniel is doing anything like especially revolutionary here. I mean, everyone knows the arm triangle. They are just, in some cases, more dedicated to it than a lot of other MMA fighters, I'd say, and grapplers. And the results have been pretty outstanding because it is a choke that is ideally suited for MMA. And that about does it for Inside the Guard this week. The show will be back for the aftermath of Brandon Thatch versus Benson Henderson as the UFC attempts to ruin all of our love lives by putting the return of the ultra-violent prospect Brandon Thatch on Valentine's Day. Thank you very much for that. And we'll continue to be posted on Bloody Elbow the Tuesday after any major event, excluding certain low-profile TV cards and Fight Pass cards. And keep an eye out for the scouting reports on Bloody Elbow by myself and Zane Simon. The extra pieces for the featherweight division are posting very soon. I believe the first one by myself focusing on grappling prospects in the featherweight division is going up on Monday of this week. And Zane Simon should be following it up within about 7 days. And then we are going to be moving on to the middleweight division. Aside from that, have a fantastic week and a great Valentine's Day, and I will see you on the other side of Brandon Thatch versus Benson Henderson. Sunshine when it's on, you niggas know to be gone every time, 'cause we don't play.